It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. Coming up, what do the University of Utah, Jack Daniels, and Carnival Cruise Lines have in common? Steve has the answer. We'll also talk about the number one way ransomware gets on your system. It's not what you think. Steve has an explanation. And then we'll take a look at an amazing bit of research showing how you can pick a lock just by listening. It's all coming up next on Security Now. Security Now comes to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/Twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 781, recorded Tuesday, August 25th, 2020. Spiky. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Thinking about moving your data storage to the cloud? Wasabi is enterprise-class cloud storage at one-fifth the price of Amazon S3 and faster than the competition, with no fees for egress or API requests and no complex storage tiers. Start a free trial at wasabi.com and enter the code SecurityNow. And by Security Scorecard. Security Scorecard helps enterprises manage digital threats with a 360-degree view of cybersecurity health through a single pane of glass. To learn more and sign up for your free account, visit securityscorecard.com/twit. And by ExtraHop. ExtraHop helps keep your business secure and available with SaaS-based cloud-native network detection and response. Learn more about how ExtraHop stops breaches 70% faster and experience the free trial for yourself at extrahop.com/securitynow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your safety, your privacy, your security online with our major domo, the man in charge, Mr. Steve Gibson. Hello, Steve.
Yo, Leo.
Good to see you.
I did confirm
that
this is the launch of year 16.
Wow.
It was August 19th, which was last Wednesday of 2005, that was our maiden voyage on this journey that you proposed 15 years ago.
Thank God you didn't have a crystal ball.
Because no, Leo, you're one of my longest lasting relationships.
Same here. Same here. And I've never cheated on you, Steve, not once. So there.
Wait a minute. There have been others.
There have been others. Yes, I admit.
I happen to know there have been others.
Spoken to Bruce Schneider.
But I've been able to share in those experiences as well.
That's
so
true.
In fact, we got another strange one relationship
coming up. You and I, we're going to be doing an event in October to celebrate October Security 1st. Month.
October 1st.
Yeah, that'll be. We'll have details of that.
Until then, we have a little bit of a play on words. It's not my play on words, it's theirs. Spiky, S-P-I, capital K-E-Y, we're going to talk about an incredibly cool bit of technology an opportunity to sort of, you know, step back a little bit and look at the landscape of the low-tech meets high-tech, essentially. But we'll get to that. First, we're going to talk about a new Chrome remote code execution flaw, which happily people will be patching when they move to Chrome 85. I forgot to look and see whether I'm on 85 today. It's supposed to be happening today. We also have some interesting news of three new ransomware victims, two of the three very well known, an emergency patch from Microsoft, and a little bit of the backstory around that. The emergence of amateur remote desktop protocol exploiters, and weirdly coincident with this podcast's 15th birthday, which occurred, was it last week or this week? Anyway, I get these zero-based or one-based issues are a constant source of programming bugs and also brain bugs for me. Anyway, the 15th birthday of the zero-day initiative. Actually, I guess it would have been last week because theirs happened one day after ours.
This is the world's first null terminated podcast. So I understand your confusion. Perfect. Yeah.
Yes. Very good. We also have, I found finally a good Windows 10 garbageware remover that I'm going to talk about. I'm going to offer some recommendations of several of my most successful remote networking utilities. We've got a bit of miscellany, some Spinrite news, and then we're finally going to examine a really terrific new high-tech hack against low-tech locks and keys. And of course, we've got a really good picture of the
funny,
week.
Funny, very week. Funny picture so, of the week yeah. this week. Yeah,
yeah.
And also apropos. Great. I'm excited. Another great show in the offing. Before we delve into those mighty matters, let me talk a little bit about something very hot. Wasabi. Not the wasabi horseradish that you have with your sushi. The wasabi hot cloud storage that I am such a big fan of. You know, and I admit I'm a little prejudiced. It was founded by two of my great friends, specifically David Friend, who was the CEO of Carbonite, but he's a serial entrepreneur going way back to his days designing the ARP synthesizer, working with Stevie Wonder. He's really an amazing fellow. One of the things that he and Jeff came up with in the early days of their research was a way to write to hard drives sequentially instead of sector by sector. They patented that, and it's actually was how Carbonite started and now Wasabi. It turns out it's a much faster and a much more efficient way of writing to the disk. It saves them money, so that saves you money. They pass the savings on to you. Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage is a perfect alternative for anybody who says, you know, we're going to buy more on-prem storage. In fact, we're going to get a certain amount every week, every month, every year from now on. That's very common because you look at your business. You're cranking out data at a fairly consistent pace. And in many cases, you need to save that data for a long time. That means either buying on-prem storage or finding something better. That's Wasabi. Wasabi is 80% cheaper than Amazon S3. It's significantly cheaper than on-prem storage even. In fact, typically you can store data in Wasabi's cloud for less than just the maintenance fees on that storage if you bought the drives, if you had it on premises. Less than the maintenance fees alone. Wasabi is a really great proposition. It's also a lot faster than Amazon S3. And it's compatible with S3 because it supports the S3 API. Although, unlike Amazon, Wasabi never charges for API access. They also don't charge for egress, and that's another big savings. A lot of times, you know, you'll store data in the cloud, and you say, oh, that was a good deal, and then you forget that it's going to cost you to get that data back. Never with Wasabi. Wasabi's really kind of amazing. But I know what you're thinking. You're saying, okay, fine, Leo, but with on-prem storage, at least that storage is sitting right there. It's safe. It's secure. I think you could make a very strong argument that data stored in the Wasabi cloud is actually safer and more secure. 11 nines of durability. That's as good as you can get. That means, you know, if you did the math, on average, you'd lose one file every 649,000 years. But you know what? You're not even going to lose that because it's hosted in premier tier 4 data center facilities that are redundant. Of course, highly secure as well, which means, oh, and I should throw in one extra thing. Wasabi does regular integrity checking where all objects stored are checked every 90 days. So if one bit goes missing, don't worry. It's redundant. You've got another copy of this data on another tier 4 data center or maybe 2 or 3. So you can always get it back. So you're just never going to lose data. It's also more secure because its security is turned on by default. Even if you don't specify encryption, all data stored in the Wasabi cloud is encrypted while at rest, fully encrypted. They follow industry best security models and design practices, things like access control mechanisms, bucket policies, access control lists. And I love the feature. I think this is such a great feature. Any data can be designated as immutable. You can say, this is immutable. I can't erase it. I can't change it without jumping through some hoops. Obviously, you can turn it off, but it's not easily accessed. And that means it's protected from hackers, from ransomware, from, you know, human error. That's why it's better than on-prem. Less expensive, but better than on-prem. And now, if you know you're going to be getting a certain amount every month, for instance, you can take advantage of a new way to pay. You can pay as you go. They have a simple flat fee, or you can pay with reserved capacity storage, which means, you know, I'm going to use this much every year. You can reserve that much in 1, 3, or 5 year increments. You will get bigger discounts for longer terms and more capacity. So it is getting a discount because, you know, you could say, yeah, we're going to be using this much for this long. That's fantastic. It's just another way Wasabi says, if you're an MSP and you resell storage, this is a great choice for you. You'll actually sell more and make more. You'll be charging less and you'll be making more. That's how big the price differential is. It's completely compliant with every industry, FINRA, CJIS. It's HIPAA compliant. Wasabi is highly secure, disruptive technology that's really turning the storage industry on its ear. Calculate the savings for yourself. Start a free trial right now. You can try it for a month. Go to wasabi.com, click on the free trial link, enter the code SecurityNow, bang on it for a month, absolutely free. Then go to the boss and say, look, boss, we're going to save 80%. We're going to be up to 6 times faster, and maybe you've never heard of it. Maybe, you know, you say, well, what about Amazon or Azure or Google Cloud? No, you got to try this. Wasabi. I'm on a mission to tell the world. Wasabi. Yes, spelled like the green stuff on your sushi, but it's not. Join the movement. Migrate your data to the cloud and do it with confidence. Wasabi.com. Free trial waiting for you. Offer code SecurityNow. Take advantage of this. It is a great way to save. Wasabi.com. We thank them so much for supporting Security Now and the whole Twit network. We're big fans. Picture of the week.
So, yeah. It's a 4-frame cartoon. The first one shows the very familiar Internet Explorer E with some weird black shrouded hand, skeleton hand, trying to pull it off screen, and the hand gives up and sort of breaks free. And then we see in the third frame that we have the Grim Reaper, and Grim Reaper is saying, in the first frame it says, it's time to go, and the Internet Explorer resists apparently. And so then the Grim Reaper in the third frame says, let's go. And then the fourth frame is Internet Explorer is not responding.
Very familiar.
Which familiar to us all. And the Grim Reaper is puzzled that it's unable to remove it. And this was apropos of something that I meant to talk about last week, but didn't. because it, just under a year from now, on August 17th of 2021, the use of IE 11, our last IE, will no longer be supported for Microsoft's online services like Office 365, OneDrive, Outlook, and more. And of course, this is significant. We often hear Paul and Mary Jo talking about how corporations have built IE in as a component of their infrastructure with like custom apps and things that's all glued in. And they've got a year until, you know, it really stops being supported. And also, Microsoft will be ending support for IE 11 with Microsoft Teams web app later this year, and all support ending on November 30th. So, you know, the clock is ticking, and corporations really need to be looking at Edge. Now, I don't know whether the IE 11 compatibility mode built into Edge will continue or not. But for what it's worth, standalone IE, you know, sooner or later, the Grim Reaper is going to succeed. And in fact, that Grim Reaper may actually be named Microsoft. Google Chrome users should today be moving to Chrome 85. Most users don't need to do anything, which is good. It just updates itself. But this will fix a potentially serious remote code execution vulnerability in Chrome's WebGL rendering engine. It's a use-after-free read flaw, which was discovered by Cisco's Talos security group, and it was responsibly reported to Google more than 3 months ago, back on May 19th. Google quickly put the fix into their early release cycle in the dev and the beta channels just a couple weeks later in early June, and the stable channel, which I and most of us use, is expected to be receiving that fix today when Chrome moves from 84 to 85. I looked last night. I was on 84. I could look right now, come to think of it, because I've got Chrome right here. Let's see. Help about. And check it. Oh, updating Google Chrome. Yes, I'm still on 84, but in a few moments, I will be on 85. So you may need to go to help about to kind of give it a little kick. That sometimes is necessary.
I think if you close it, it will download it. And then if you close it, it will but most of us never close our browsers.
That's right. I you know, for me, Firefox is just open statically, and you need to go to help about, and then it goes, yeah, thanks for asking. And then it updates itself and sometimes needs to do typically needs to close and then reopen with all of the tabs surviving. Fortunately, because as we saw last week, I need all of those 1,000 tabs that I have open. I know it's not 1,000, but it has a scroll bar. So, yeah, wouldn't fit on one screen. So what do the University of Utah, Jack Daniel's Whiskey, and Carnival Cruise Lines all have in common? Well, last Friday, the University of Utah revealed that it had paid a ransomware gang $457.59.
$457,000.
Yes, sorry. I got.
That would have been a bargain.
$450,059, which sort of begs the question, where'd they get that number? Now that I finally got it out correctly.
It's probably the Bitcoin conversion.
$459.
Yeah, like $500,000. It's like the Bitcoin conversion thing. They probably was.
It had to have been that. Yes, some round number of Bitcoin that turned out to be that. And what's interesting is that was not to obtain the decryption key for their files. They didn't need it because it turns out that very few of their files were encrypted, but rather. And Leo, I know this goes to, you know, the thing that where you just kind of like grit your teeth to purchase the promise from the extortionists that the student information that had been exfiltrated beforehand.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's
would
so
not
bad.
Be publicly released.
You're going to see more and more of this one. This is big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're hoping that there is honor among thieves, and that these guys will keep their word.
Incentive to keep your word is that if you want others to pay you,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's it exactly.
Yeah.
Of course, ransomware gangs are not all the same, but and didn't we hear? Oh no, it wasn't. It was Canon that had some information leaked last week that we reported on. And so Lawrence over at Bleeping Computer has said that, you know, they assumed since Canon got themselves back up relatively quickly that they had paid the ransom. But now, since the extortionists in that instance were leaking the information, maybe Canon had restored from backups and said, nah, we're not paying your stinking ransom. And the bad guy said, okay, here comes your private corporate next decade plans, for the future? How do you want that? How do you feel about that being leaked? Anyway, so the in this case, the University of Utah explained that it had dodged a major ransomware incident and that the attackers managed to encrypt only 0.02% of the data stored on their servers. And the university staff was easily able to restore that from backups. However, the ransomware group then threatened to release student-related data
they
had obtained and exfiltrated. So the university said, after careful consideration, the university decided to work with its cyber insurance provider to pay a fee to the ransomware attacker. This was done as a proactive and preventative step to ensure information was not released on the internet. And again, to the extent that such can be insured, the university's cyber insurance policy paid part of the ransom, and the university covered the remainder. No tuition, grant, donation, state, or taxpayer funds were used to pay the ransom. I thought that was an interesting, explicit statement that they made. And they said the university disclosed that the attack took place a little over a month ago on July 19th, 2020, and that the network belonging to the College of Social and Behavioral Science was the victim. So apparently a subset of the entire larger university was where the break-in occurred, and there must have been some isolation there. So anyway, that is one of the three, and presumably they were able to negotiate a cheaper payment in order to, because the bad guys hadn't managed to get the bulk of the university stuff. But they did pay for the promise to not share student data. Wow. And as you said, Leo, the reason that would be honored is, well, they got, as you know, nearly $500,000, and they
want to do it again.
To use that. Yeah, exactly.
You got to build your credibility.
Exactly. And two other large and notable recent ransomware victims were Brown-Forman, famous for their distillation of Jack Daniel's Tennessee whiskey, and Carnival Cruises. The Jack Daniels folks said our quick actions upon discovering the attack prevented our systems from being encrypted. Unfortunately, again, we believe some information, including employee data, was impacted. We are working closely with law enforcement as well as world-class third-party data security experts to mitigate and resolve this situation as soon as possible. There are no active negotiations. So in that, that says, it sort of sounds like, that statement from Brown-Forman came after Bloomberg News reported that it had received an anonymous tip of the ransomware attack, a site on the dark web claiming to be run by members of the Reville strain of ransomware, says that it had obtained a terabyte of data from the Louisville, Kentucky-based Brown-Forman. The site said that stolen data included contracts, financial statements, credit histories, and internal correspondence of employees. Also included were screenshots of file structures and documents purportedly taken during the heist. So it does look like the pattern we're seeing now is because, major companies that have the deep pockets also have the pocket depth to now proactively back up their servers. Well, so it's possible if the only thing done was encryption, a golden opportunity to extract a ransom could be thwarted if the good guys have backups. And so now what's being done is the data pre-encryption is being exfiltrated and stored somewhere. Then the data is encrypted. And so we have, we're increasingly seeing this two-part attack: exfiltration, that the company desperately does not want to be made public in case they have backups, in which case they would not otherwise need to pay the extortion. So, you know, it's not really ransomware as much as it is, okay, we got copies of all your stuff. Shall we share it with the world?
It's plain old blackmail.
Yep. And as for Carnival Corporation, the operator of the world's biggest cruise lines, they disclosed that they were hit by a ransomware attack that provided unauthorized access to personal data of passengers and employees.
That could be bad because that could be passport information as well as address, name, birth date. I don't know if they collect socials, but boy, that's a lot of information they have. And credit card numbers, of course.
Do they have passport information? Because they're taking you across.
Yeah, when you sign up for a cruise, and it's very rare that a cruise is just within one nation. If you're going to another country, they collect your passport, so they have screenshots of it.
They physically will they hold it while you're with us.
Yeah.
Wow. Yep.
So
the company is not yet identified. Huh?
I've been on many of their cruise lines because they own.
Yeah. Well,
Holland America was one of them. Yep. And that was Holland America. Seabourn was a recent cruise of mine. And of course, Carnival is a big one in and of its own right. They own a lot of the cruise lines.
Well, in fact, you and Lisa like the whole cruise modality.
Oh, we love cruises. We won't be going on one anytime soon.
Them were the days.
Yeah. Yep. I look back on that with nostalgia and affection. The good old days.
Yeah, I was actually talking to my buddy Mark Thompson, whom you know. He's launched a little project to provide air quality monitoring in real time to health clubs.
Oh, he should. And he must. That's great.
Yeah.
Good for him.
And in fact, I don't know how much of this I can talk about. So I just realized. But we were talking about the air quality in cruise lines as opposed to airliners. And it turns out that it's like the air is fully completely exchanged on an airplane very often.
Right.
But not so on a cruise line, which deliberately maintains a closed cycle system because the external air is often not what passengers want to be breathing.
It's kind of muggy.
No control over humidity. Yeah. It's subtropical or whatever.
It's very muggy. Although the lines the small ships I go on, we always have a balcony and windows we can open, and we always eat outside. So I'm not too worried about that. But, yeah, I would imagine some of those big ships, you're not breathing outside air ever.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
And so it is internally recycled and not of the highest quality. So anyway, Carnival said that they had not yet identified which of their many subsidiary lines was breached. But because they are publicly traded, they did need to disclose to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission the nature of the attack. In their regulatory filing, they said, based on its preliminary assessment and on the information currently known, in particular, that the incident occurred in a portion of a brand's information technology systems, the company, capital C, does not believe the incident will have a material impact on its business operations or financial results. Nonetheless, we expect that the security event included unauthorized access to personal data of guests and employees, which may result in potential claims from guests, employees, shareholders, or regulatory agencies. Although we believe that no other information technology systems of the other company's brands have been impacted by this incident based upon our investigation to date, there can be no assurance that other information technology systems of the company's brands will not be adversely affected. So a CYA statement for the regulatory requirements. Which brings me to an interesting set of reports that were just released. Certainly, we all likely agree that a ransomware attack is the last thing any company wants, given what we keep seeing. So the question is, how exactly are these occurring? The traditional answer has been phishing email, which hooks some well-meaning but unsuspecting insider. Well, while phishing email is indeed a popular entry point vector, these three recent reports from Coveware, MSIS Soft and Recorded Future clearly show that phishing actually takes a backseat to our old friend RDP. And I have a chart on page 2 of the notes, which is really interesting. This is a ransomware attack vectors over time. And it would be a pie chart, except a pie chart can't show percentage change over time. So this is a line chart from fourth quarter of 2018 through the second quarter of 2020, so up to current, where it's showing the percent of cases of RDP compromise, email phishing, software vulnerability, or other. So it's like a pie chart varying over time. So consequently, for example, in the fourth quarter of 2018, by far and away, the majority of the attacks, looks like maybe just eyeballing it, maybe 85% were RDP. Came down as a percentage.
This can't be right. Is RDP that big a problem?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Holy cow. I mean,
these guys provide the raw data to back that up.
And it's Windows RDP, right? It's Microsoft Windows.
Windows is 100% RDP. So email phishing did come up as a percentage, which pushed the percentage of RDP down, but it's holding its own. And then, of course, what happened in 2020 and in the first and second quarters of 2020 is due to the COVID and the dramatic increase of hastily brought up RDP services in order to allow remote access that began, that essentially began fighting with email phishing as an entry point. So those are the two, but email phishing never even reached parity with RDP. It's gone up and down, but RDP is holding its own, which I think is one of the things that I'm going to spend some time talking about here. In their report, MSIS Soft explained what's happened this year. They said, in recent months, organizations across every sector have come to rely heavily on remote desktop protocol to maintain business continuity while respecting social distancing. And I'll back up a little bit, Leo, just to address your comment. Remember that there have been a series of really bad authentication problems with RDP.
Oh, I know.
This is why I've been saying, who the hell uses RDP?
Don't they use VPNs and other solutions? Who's using RDP?
No.
That's nuts.
No, there are 80,000 exposed RDP services on the internet. It is absolutely crazy. But they're just assuming that, it must be secure because Microsoft says we can turn it on. Well, Microsoft said that once about Windows printer and file sharing.
See,
we know how that
went. I mean, Barracuda in their ad says 91% of all ransomware attacks come through phishing emails, spear phishing emails. And every one I've heard about is a spear phishing email. I can't imagine Canon or Carnival or any of these people is using RDP. That's crazy.
Well, in terms of number, I'm sure it's the smaller guys that aren't deploying the technology that they need to.
Right.
Anyway, so Emphasoft said, however, the rapid shift to remote working has also provided a unique opportunity for ransomware groups. Threat actors predicted that many organizations would not have the time or resources to securely implement RDP during the mass transition to working from home, and as a result, may be vulnerable to compromise. They were right. According to a McAfee report, the number of internet-exposed RDP ports grew from approximately, oh boy, I lowballed it, from approximately, are you sitting down, Leo?
Yeah.
3 million in January of 2020 to more than 4.5 million in March. So in less than 3 months, an additional 1.5 million additional RDP ports became publicly exposed. Later in their report, they note that while the threat is not new, and of course, as we know all too well on this podcast, the global shift to remote working has revealed that many organizations do not adequately secure RDP and that the bad guys are taking advantage. According to a report by Kaspersky, at the start of March 2020, there were about 200,000 daily brute force RDP attacks in the U.S. But by mid-April, just 6 weeks later, that number had grown from 200,000 to nearly 1.3 million brute force attacks per day. Now, today, RDP is regarded as the single biggest attack vector for ransomware. So all of these 4.5 million RDP ports are publicly exposed, and they are being actively attacked. And what is, to me, shocking is that even now, Microsoft has not stepped up and offered better security. And so, you know, of course, this obviously underscores the point I've been making, which is that RDP simply cannot be safely exposed to the public internet. And there are two reasons. It's no longer sane to trust that Microsoft hasn't or won't make a mistake in their provision of the RDP service. They've done so over and over in the past. And as we'll be learning in a few minutes, they just released an emergency patch for two more privilege elevation flaws in Windows remote access service, which is what RDP is part of. The second reason we cannot trust RDP is that its native authentication mechanism are pathetic. I went looking for something that I thought I might not know about RDP authentication, thinking Microsoft must have fixed this. And I found a very recent, it was only a couple months old, best practices advisory from Microsoft on securing RDP authentication. It amounted to be sure to use a strong password. There is zero multi-factor support for RDP, which is unconscionable. There are multiple third parties who have responded to this need created by Microsoft by creating their own much more secure RDP gateways, which are laden with authentication features. So, you know, if you don't feel like rolling your own solution and you do have money to burn, because none of these third-party solutions are inexpensive, you could simply throw some money at the problem and buy yourself this much-needed security. Or you could get a bit clever and roll your own. If the clients you have connecting have fixed IPs, restricting access to the RDP port from only those IPs is an immediate, proven, fast, and secure solution. If the IPs are largely fixed, as with the typical residential broadband service, The use of a Dyn DNS solution can allow for tracking their infrequent but possible changes. And typical changes may be so infrequent that updating the access firewall from Dyn DNS doesn't even need to be automated. I know that the IPs that I maintain in my two locations, I mean, they're essentially static. They haven't changed like in years. But if highly dynamic roaming access is needed, then no form of IP-based access restriction will suffice. This lifts the requirement for authentication from the network layer to the application layer. Again, history teaches that what we must avoid is public access to an RDP endpoint. There's no safe way to protect it. We can't trust Microsoft, and we can't allow for this brute forcing of our authentication. 1.3 million attacks per day is ongoing right now. So that requires the use of something in front of the RDP endpoint. I've talked about using a VPN offering some form of where the VPN offers some form of strong multi-factor authentication, either a time-based one-time password or certificate-based. But I wanted to add another option to the pot by noting that SSH is widely available, almost always offers the very strong authentication options that we're looking for, and it can be used to tunnel RDP. In fact, if you Google tunnel RDP over SSH, you'll be rewarded with all the suggestions you might need and for all OS platforms. The only theoretical downside is that as a purist, both RDP and SSH use TCP. Long ago, when we were first covering the operation of VPNs in this podcast's deep history, I noted that there can be some tunnel confusion when TCP is tunneled inside TCP, since then you have two sets of TCP's error recovery and packet retransmission. The theoretical optimal solution is for the VPN tunnel to use dumb old UDP packets, and for the tunneled protocol to use UDP packets for the tunneled protocol, and then RDP over TCP, which is carried by the UDP tunnel. So that way, the RDP's TCP protocol handles any packet losses and retransmission, and those are carried over UDP. I did find some SSH UDP tunneling systems, but there is so much apparent success with simply tunneling RDP over standard SSH TCP tunnels that it appears my theoretical concerns might be nothing more than that, just theoretical. So anyway, I wanted to propose another option to the need for somehow hiding RDP endpoints from the outside world. It's clearly necessary to add some other layer of security in front of RDP.
Somebody in our chat whose company uses it say this: they use a proxy server in front of it, so it's not publicly available IP address.
Right.
Yeah, which makes
right.
a lot of sense.
You just have to hide it.
Yeah.
And I'll mention one more Microsoft issue, and then we'll take our second break. Last Thursday, Microsoft issued an emergency out-of-cycle update for Windows 8.1, 8.1 RT, and Windows Server, the matching server instance of 8.1, which was Windows Server 2012 R2. The emergency update patches a pair of recently disclosed security vulnerabilities. I have a link in the show notes because from my reading of this, it doesn't look like this is going to be an automatic update. Maybe they'll roll them out next month. What's interesting is they're both high severity privilege escalation vulnerabilities residing in the remote access service, which is obviously a particularly vulnerable area of a server. Interestingly, both of these vulnerabilities were patched as part of the previous week's August Patch Tuesday, but that was for Windows 10, Windows 7 for those on extended support, and Windows Server 2008, 2012, 2016, 2019, and Windows Server versions 1903, 1909, and 2004 systems. In other words, everything other than Windows 8.1 and its corresponding server 2012 R2. So as near as I can determine, it's just that these patches for those two operating systems just weren't ready in time to make, you know, whatever quality control, if any, Microsoft is applying to the monthly patch cycle. But at the same time, they were too critical for Microsoft to leave them hanging, since somebody examining the patches, and we now know that happens, somebody examining the patches for the other OSs could probably figure out what it was that was fixed and note that that had not been fixed in Windows Server 2012 R2, and then perhaps, you know, go attack it by reverse engineering what had been fixed in all the other platforms. So, as I said, it may be that they need to be manually patched and installed. It wasn't clear. And assuming that they'll be part of next month's patch batch, I would say that end users probably don't need to worry, because, you know, Windows 8.1 probably doesn't have any remote access services publicly exposed in the typical end user environment behind a NAT router. So unless you're actually running Windows Server 2012 R2, you probably don't need to worry. But if you are, I would certainly think that it's worth going to get that, or making sure that it isn't already updated by Microsoft.
This Covware article, I think, tells you why it's so big, because it's one particular kind of ransomware, Phobos, that focuses on RDP. And it's ransomware as a service. So any idiot can go and all the credentials are available online for pennies. So any idiot can go either do a Shodan or get some credentials, and then you don't have to know what you're doing. Whereas any spear phishing attack, anything more sophisticated, is going to take a lot more effort. So this is low hanging fruit. You probably don't make a lot of money with it, you know. These are the $100, $200, $300 ransomwares. You're not getting $500,000.
What you have just said is exactly where we're headed after our second break. And I even use the phrase low-hanging fruit.
Now I understand, because it's counterintuitive, but of course it's not, because lots of people who don't know what they're doing are putting RDP out in the public. Which is so
exactly.
dumb.
So exactly. Exactly.
When there's so many better solutions out there. But it's, you know, it comes with Windows. Right? You know, it's available. Why not?
And yeah, turn it on.
Yeah. Wow. And then they're using Monkey123 as the password. I mean, it's got to be the same people, right?
Shh, don't tell anybody.
It's a secret.
That's mine.
It's a secret. of course, they're getting bit. It's probably,
how'd you guess it on the first try?
It's probably not very lucrative.
Wow, you're
good. Know, if you really want the money, you're going to go out and find a company and target them and take some time, and then that's when you can exfiltrate data, do all those fun things. Yeah. Make a lot more money, I would imagine. Wow, I can't believe that in this day and age, That's what's going on. That's why you need a security scorecard, our sponsor. Not only do you want the security scorecard on your company, by the way, we got a B, which I'm pretty happy about. You're going to want to get a security scorecard for any company you're doing business with. Because as we know, that's a part of the problem. What was it? Was it Target that got attacked because their HVAC partner had access to the network? And so somebody hacked maybe the HVAC guy was using RDP. They hacked the HVAC guy and then got into the bigger breach. You're giving people access to your network. You're paying people. You're using people. You want to check their security scorecard. It's the global leader in cybersecurity rankings, the only service that is continuously rating 1.5 million companies. So it almost guaranteed, if you go to Security Scorecard, by the way, that's securityscorecard.com/twit. If you go to Security Scorecard and look up an organization, you'll be able to see their scorecard right there, because they're rating everybody. This is their mission. It's to empower every organization with collaborative security intelligence, because you're only as secure as the companies you work with, right? So for us, it was important. We ran our security scorecard, and it gives you details on why you scored lower in certain areas. By the way, we are fairly highly ranked among businesses that are in our business, but I didn't want to be. And so we went and we fixed the problems associated with the lower rankings. We got an F in one score, which was apps. And that wasn't much we could do about that, actually. But at least we know where the weaknesses are. So Security Scorecard is a really great idea to give you a 360-degree view of your cybersecurity health through a single pane of glass. Their patented rating technology is used by over 1,000 organizations for lots of different reasons. Self-monitoring, of course. Just as we did, you can evaluate your organization's cybersecurity risk using real data-driven objective and continuously updating metrics that provide visibility into your information security control weaknesses, right? It's also good, though, for third-party risk management. You can see how any company you want to do business with, partners, vendors, suppliers, are treating their cybersecurity and hence how they might impact you. You want to evaluate all the risks in your ecosystem. It can also allow companies to fix and find security risks and vulnerabilities across their externally facing digital footprint. It's also great because it's so easy to read. They use those letter grades, A, B, C, D, and F, just like you learned in school. Everybody understands them. So it's great for board or executive level reporting. It's great if you're getting cyber insurance underwriting in this insurance space. Very useful. Everybody likes this idea that you can get the grade. And by the way, companies with a C, D, or F are 5 times more likely to be breached. And I don't know, I have to check, but I bet you anything they look at RDP. I'm sure they would. The data is used to calculate scores across 10 key risk factor groups. Things we talk about all the time on Security Now. Patching cadence, application security, DNS health, network security, endpoint security. You may be using individual tools in individual areas. DNS health is always one that we talk about. But this does it all. And you get a grade in every one of those 10 key risk factor groups. So it lets companies easily understand and continuously monitor their cybersecurity posture and the posture of the people they deal with. And then there's the Security Scorecard Atlas, which is the leading cybersecurity questionnaire and validation solution. It cuts through the questionnaire noise so you can find your score and make your business cyber secure. It's a centralized platform leveraging machine learning to automate the cybersecurity questionnaire exchange process for senders and receivers. I actually didn't know anything about this, but I've learned about this since this is one way companies work with other companies with the cybersecurity questionnaires. They've got a great process for this, which makes it 2 times faster. It makes it more accurate, and most importantly, it makes it more secure. Security Scorecard Atlas is the only platform in the market that instantly maps out cybersecurity rating data to individual responses. So you can see immediately they're great all the way across the board. You get a real 360-degree view of the risk you're taking on. You can also cut the questionnaire cycle in half because they've got 20-plus industry standard questionnaires. They also have a custom questionnaire wizard. So it's easy to create these questionnaires. You can collaborate easily and securely with your team and with third parties. Look, Security Scorecard was founded with the notion that every business has a right to its own security rating. That's why they give these away. You can get yours right now. In fact, you can check the score of your business and up to 5 others at securityscorecard.com/twit. Absolutely free. Best product security ratings 20 by 2020 SC Magazine. They just got that award. The combined power of Security Scorecard's ratings and their Atlas gives organizations a 360-degree view of cybersecurity for any company in the world, theirs or the companies they deal with. And you can get the score of your business and up to 5 others right now. To learn more, sign up for your free account, securityscorecard.com/twit. You at least should check your company right now. securityscorecard.com/twit. If you're doing business with other companies, you can't just say, are you guys secure? Yeah, we're secure. Okay, good. No. No. You need Security Scorecard. securityscorecard.com/twit. This is one letter grade you're really going to want to find out. Back to the show we go with Mr. Steve Gibson.
So speaking of low-hanging fruit,
yes,
Iranian script kiddies are using RDP to deploy the Dharma ransomware. This was some interesting and disturbing research by a group known as Group IB. They detailed the collision of RDP and ransomware. They explained that apparently, like from all the forensic evidence, these look like low-skilled hackers. Well, I'll explain why in a second. Likely from Iran, have joined the ransomware business, targeting companies in Russia, India, China, and Japan. They're going after the new low-hanging fruit represented by casually or hastily deployed RDP servers using publicly available tools. The group is deploying the Dharma ransomware, and based on the forensic artifacts of the attacks, it appears to be a non-sophisticated, purely financially, as opposed to, for example, politically or state-level motivated group, which is new to cybercrime. Their extortion demands range, they're pretty modest, from 1 to 5 Bitcoin, which puts it at around, what, $11,700 up to maybe $60,000. And they locate targets the old-fashioned way, by scanning IP address ranges for exposed remote desktop protocol RDP endpoints. Their tool of choice is a freely available open-source port scanner called MassScan, we've talked about before. Once they've located a potential target, which is to say they found port 3389 open, they launch a brute force authentication attack using another tool, NLBrute, which is a utility that simply repeatedly attempts to authenticate against RDP using a list of username and passwords, attempting to find a combination that works. If they get in, they sometimes attempt to elevate their privileges by exploiting an old vulnerability which exists in Windows 7 through 10. And researchers at this company, Group IB, learned about the new group a couple of months ago in June during an incident response engagement at a company in Russia that had been attacked. Based on that forensic analysis and the artifacts from that, they determined that the attacker to probably be a Persian-speaking newbie. The conclusion is supported by clues from the next stages that they found of the attack, which appear to lack the confidence that you would expect from an actor who knows essentially what to do once they've gotten in. Group IB, it's like, we got in.
What do you recommend now?
Group IB wrote, interestingly, the threat actors likely don't have a clear plan for what to do with the compromised networks. Once they've established the RDP connection, they decide which tools to deploy to move laterally. For instance, to disable built-in AV software, the attackers used Defender Control and Your Uninstaller, which are, you know, tools available, sort of generic, in order to get done what they want. Nothing very sophisticated there. Further evidence that the operation is the work of a script kiddie from Iran comes from search queries in Persian to find other tools necessary for the attack. It's like, okay, let's see. What should we search for now?
It's probably a 12-year-old.
Yeah. Anyway, those searches were turned up in Persian language Telegram channels, which provide those tools.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
The number of victims compromised so far by this attacker is not known. nor is the path that led the threat actor to the Dharma ransomware as a service operation, you know, RAAS. But given that the Dharma operators provide a toolkit that makes it easy for anyone to become a cyber criminal, it should not come as a surprise that inexperienced individuals are deploying this file encrypting malware. It's like, wait, now we're supposed to launch the Dharma once they get in. So the senior analyst at Group IB, a guy named Oleg Skulkin, said that the Dharma ransomware source code, which was leaked in March, likely explained the increasing use of this malware strain. Oleg indicated that, quote, it's surprising that Dharma landed in the hands of Iranian script kiddies who are using it for financial gain, as Iran has traditionally been a land of state-sponsored attacks engaged in espionage and sabotage. So in other words, you know, maybe it's not that surprising because it's sort of now available for everyone, not just state-level actors. And of course, we've talked about how this new ransomware as a service model is allowing many hackers who would never be in the ransomware game to become players. And, you know, I don't, given that we have ransomware as a service now, I don't see how this problem is ever going to go away. So again, no exposed open RDP ports, okay? Not for our listeners. Arrange to put something, anything, in front of RDP so that you or your company are not open to exploitation. You know, this is not as bad as Microsoft's original wide-open Windows file and printer sharing, which is what drove me to create GRC's Shields Up service so many years ago, but it does definitely need attention. No exposed RDP ports. The Zero Day Initiative, ZDI, that we've also referred to recently, turned 15. As I mentioned at the top of the show, it turns out that there's a bit of a synchronized 15th birthday since last Thursday. Pwn2Own's founding parent, the Zero Day Initiative, also turned 15, just as this podcast did. Our first podcast, as I mentioned, was August 15th, 2005, one day before the founding of the ZDI program.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, one day. On last week's occasion of their 15th birthday, ZDI announced that more than $25 million in bounties had been paid to security researchers over the past decade and a half. Those monies went to more than 10,000 security researchers across more than 7,500 successful bug submissions. In explaining the genesis of ZDI, they said, starting in 2005, 3Com, remember them? 3Com announced a new program called the Zero Day Initiative. The plan was to financially reward researchers who discovered previously unknown software vulnerabilities and disclose them responsibly. The information about the vulnerability would be used to provide early protection to customers through Tipping Point's IPS, their intrusion prevention system, the filters for that, while the Zero Day Initiative then worked with the affected product's vendor to fix the vulnerability. So that's an interesting angle here. The commercial Tipping Point IPS would benefit from providing immediate awareness of a vulnerability and could offer their proprietary customers, their commercial customers, unique early protection thanks to the IPSs being immediately updated before any fix was available from the vendor, which, as we know, could take like 90 days or more. That would then, of course, the vendor would then fix the problem downstream of the IPS eventually. But even after the vendor's problem was fixed, there's certainly some value in knowing when attacks are being launched against one's IPS protection, even when there's no, you know, back-end vulnerability any longer. So anyway, that's how this happened, is that 3Com said, let's get in the business of collecting this information from hackers that will allow us to mature our intrusion protection system in advance of any vendors' vulnerabilities being fixed. We offer our protected customers this window of safety for their own back-end systems, and we're going to turn this into a commercial venture. So they ended up saying that first year, the ZDI published a total of one advisory pertaining to Symantec's Veritas Net Backup. 15 years later, they said, we've now published, as I said at the top, 1,500 advisories as we evolved into the world's largest vendor-agnostic bug bounty program. To say it's been a journey is an understatement. It certainly had some ups and downs, but the program is stronger than ever and on track for our largest year ever. As we begin our 16th year, as we did last week, let's take a look at some of the more notable happenings in the life of the ZDI program. So I read through the entire posting, and it provided such a useful and synchronized perspective and walk through the 15 years of this podcast, I decided I wanted to share it with our listeners. So here's what they said through the years of 2005 through 2010, their first 5 years, they wrote, looking back at our activities through these years induces nostalgia as it reminds us of the bugs we bought in products and companies that are no longer with us. We can also see the rise of research into different products and technologies. For example, we bought only 2 Apple bugs in 2006. That number rose to 52 by 2010. Java bugs, particularly sandbox escapes, were also popular during this time. And of course, we were talking about them on this podcast all the time. They wrote, it's a bit odd to look back at the progression from buying bugs in what was simply known as Java to buying bugs in Sun Microsystems Java to buying bugs in Oracle's Java. This time period also saw the first Pwn2Own contest, which was in 2007. The contest launched at the time when I'm a Mac, I'm a PC commercials dominated the airwaves and Apple devices. Remember that? Yeah.
Long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah. And Apple devices had an aura of invincibility about them. Astute security researchers knew better, and Dino Dizovi proved it, winning himself a MacBook and $10,000. The contest has grown exponentially since then. There are now 3 different competitions: Pwn2Own Vancouver, the main one that we often cover, we always cover, which focuses on enterprise software; Pwn2Own Tokyo, which focuses on consumer devices; and Pwn2Own Miami, introduced this year with a focus on SCADA products. Pwn2Own also served as a coming out for many high-profile researchers who, after winning the contest, went on to work on various prestigious teams and projects. So, from 2010 to 2015, their second 5-year block, they said this was a transitional period for the program as 3Com, together with ZDI, was purchased by Hewlett-Packard, then later split off as part of HP Enterprise. However, the core principles upon which the program was founded remain the core principles we operate by today. Four of them: encourage the responsible disclosure of zero-day vulnerabilities to the affected vendors, fairly credit and compensate the participating researchers, including yearly bonuses for researchers who are especially productive within the program, hold product vendors accountable by setting a reasonable deadline for remediating reported vulnerabilities. And remember, we talked about a six-month ZDI, the patience that ZDI had for 6 months, and then finally disclosed it publicly. That was one of Microsoft's, one of those two 0 days that Microsoft didn't fix until ZDI disclosed it, and then they thought, uh-oh, because they just dragged their heels. And finally, protect our customers and the larger ecosystem. So they said by this time, the ZDI was large enough to have an impact on the overall ecosystem. It was during this period that we grew to become the world's largest vendor-agnostic bug bounty program, a title we still hold. In 2011, we had our first public zero-day disclosure when a vendor failed to meet the patch deadline. Over the years, holding vendors accountable has helped lower their response time from more than 180 days to less than 120. Even though we reduced our disclosure window, the rate of zero-day disclosure stayed relatively consistent. Another big change during this period was the increase in research work done by the vulnerability researchers employed by the ZDI program. There have always been great people working on the program doing root cause analysis on submissions, but an increase in the size of the team allowed for members of ZDI to begin reporting their own bugs as well. ZDI researchers increasingly published their findings and expanded their speaking at high-profile conferences, including Black Hat and DEF CON. The increased size also helped spot some trends in exploitation. It was during this time that we saw a surge in submissions of Java bugs. However, once browsers implemented click-to-play, practical exploitation became much more difficult. Bugs exploiting use-after-free conditions in IE were also quite common until the isolated heap and MemGC mitigation were silently introduced by Microsoft. ZDI researchers found a way to exploit the mitigations and were awarded $125,000 from Microsoft for their submission. Interestingly, Microsoft chose not to fix all the submitted bugs, so a portion of the report ended up as a public release 0 day. And they said, in case you're wondering, all of the money was donated to various STEM charities. During this time frame, the bug bounty landscape became normalized and broadened. Vendors such as Microsoft and Google started their own bounty programs, and bug bounty programs were created that allowed companies like Starbucks and Uber to offer bounties. And as we know, by bug bounty programs were created, what they mean, without naming them, of course, is HackerOne, which we have spoken of often and just recently. They wrote, the idea of crowdsourcing research entered the mainstream. Not every program was successful, as some vendors suddenly realized that if you offer money for bug reports, you get bug reports. This left some companies scrambling to react after starting their program with mixed results. It was definitely a time of growth and learning throughout the industry. Pwn2Own continued to grow as well. 2010 saw Pwn2Own's first successful mobile device exploit, demonstrated by Ralph Philip Weinman and Vincenzo Iozzo against the Apple iPhone 3GS. We also started seeing vendors release large patches just before the contest, since the rules require the latest version for all exploits. Pwn2Own contestants often found themselves patched out just before the contest. It also meant the ZDI had to scramble to get the targets up to date with all the latest patches, often staying up all night installing updates. In 2012, a second contest, Mobile Phone to Own, was added to focus on phones and tablets. And finally, the final 5 years, 15-20 to present. In 2015, Trend Micro acquired the HP Tipping Point IPS and the ZDI program along with it. This opened a new world of opportunity for ZDI, as the vulnerability intelligence produced by the ZDI program could now be used to improve not only the Tipping Point IPS, but other products within Trend Micro's line of security solutions as well. ZDI's association with Trend Micro also resulted in a massive increase in interest and vulnerabilities in Trend Micro products themselves. To their credit, Trend Micro product teams have not shied away from the work of fixing the bugs submitted by independent ZDI researchers, and we have established a targeted initiative program just for select Trend products. The threat landscape shifted as well. Before 2012, we rarely saw an Adobe Reader submission outside of Pwn to Own. Once we reached 2012, there were more than 100 submissions. Many of those reports were submitted by ZDI researchers. Overall, internal finds represent about 20% of all the cases we process every year. Bugs affecting Acrobat, Foxit, and other PDF readers continue to be prevalent. But we've also seen the rise of deserialization bugs and a sharp increase in SCADA vulnerabilities. Home routers have also become a popular target, since they can be compromised en masse to be used in botnets and DDoS attacks. As a result, the ZDI adapted and began accepting hardware-related submissions, especially those related to IoT devices. The production of the Wassenaar arrangement posed some challenges, especially when purchased bug reports from member countries. However, we were able to navigate the paperwork needed to transfer cyber arms and stay on the right side of the law. The virtualization category was introduced to Pwn to Own in 2016, and since that time, we've had several guest-to-host escapes demonstrated. And of course, we've talked about those on the podcast. The contest celebrated its 10th anniversary in 2017 by acquiring 51 zero-day vulnerabilities over the three-day contest. In 2019, we partnered with Tesla to award a Model 3 to a pair of researchers who exploited the car's infotainment system. ZDI researchers also demonstrated their own exploit of the infotainment system. The contestants have changed over the years as well. In the beginning, individual researchers made up the majority of entries, but with only a few teams participating. At one point, this shifted to most participants being teams sponsored by their employers. There have been instances of teams filling bug reports with vendors before the contest in the hopes of killing their competitors' exploits. In the past couple of years, that has shifted back towards individuals and small independent teams. And we've never stopped growing. We hit our peak of 1,450 published advisories in 2018, and we're set to eclipse that this year. In fact, we've been recognized as the world's leading vulnerability research organization for the past 15 years. According to Omidia, the ZDI was responsible for over half of all measured vulnerability disclosures in 2019, more than any other vendor. And finally, moving forward, they said, over the past 15 years, we've seen trends in exploit economy and vulnerability marketplace come and go. But through it all, we've been laser focused on one thing, making the digital world more secure, one CVE at the time. Through the tireless work of ZDI researchers and the wider community, we've determined to continue disrupting the vast cybercrime economy and raising the bar for enterprise software security for the next 15 years and beyond. So anyway, interesting walk through the past 15 years, which pretty much corresponds with the podcast. And we've covered all this stuff along the way.
Completely parallel.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So a couple of bits of miscellany. I mentioned that I had finally found what I consider to be a useful bloatware remover for Windows 10. I actually knew about it before, and I had forgotten about it, and I was reminded of it from by a tweet for something else this company does. And I thought, oh yeah, I remember O&O. Anyway, they're O ampersand O, O&O, and the one I like is O&O App Buster. If you just Google O ampersand O space App Buster, you'll find it from O&O Software. It's free. They have some various commercial offerings. So I think this is sort of a bit of a loss leader for them. But of all the things I've tried, I like this one the best. It is comprehensive. If you enable the display of hidden things, which you probably should not, then you are able to really, get yourself in trouble. But anyway, I just wanted to point our listeners at O&O App Buster as it's a nice utility. You don't need to install it. It just runs standalone. So you can, if you just, drop it on your desktop, if you make changes, it will create a little companion file outside of itself where it stores those changes, but that also allows you to move them around. Anyway, I like it a lot. And it's what I've been using and I will continue to use when I want to decrapify a new installation of Windows 10 with, all this ridiculous animated tiles and candy cane crap. I can't believe what's been done to Windows. On a serious note, I've been using something now for about a year that I can honestly say I have fallen in love with. It is a modest program called Remote Utilities for Windows. It is paid and it's a commercial app. It's a remote control app. I've looked around at them all and went through a period about a year ago of trying them all. In my case, the need was that Lori, my significant other, whom you've all heard me mention from time to time, we wanted to set her up with the ability to do remote neurofeedback. What that meant was that she would send out a laptop, an EEG amplifier, and the required EEG electrodes. In that laptop would be a bunch of software which would provide real-time feedback about her clients, some aspects of her clients' brain functioning. And it works like regular, any sort of feedback where you see it exposes something that your brain is doing and you learn to push it in the direction you're supposed to, and you're able to thus modify the function of your brain. It works. She's had a whole bunch of interesting and really heartwarming successes, especially with kids. But the point is, she needed remote access to these laptops. She needed to be able to work with the person remotely, change settings, basically remote control. I looked at everything, and this is what we've been using for the last year, And it is such a win. I just wanted to put it on our listeners' radar. As I said, it's commercial. It is not a subscription. Being an old fart myself, I would not consider it if it had to pay by the month. And, you know, everything is turning into a subscription model, which just irks me. So they have a number of different licenses to suit enterprise needs. If you're just if you have modest needs, they have a free license that will allow you to put the connection settings for up to 10 remote machines in your viewer's address book. I purchased a license because, and in fact, Greg, my own tech support guy, has a little business on the side helping his clients. He completely fell in love with it and has switched to using it. Lori has, as I said, been using it for a year. So
how much?
It's not expensive. You can find if they have like various pricing plans. Again, you can use free for free. You can put 10 remote computers under control. There's the host app that is what goes on the remote machine. What they call the viewer is used by you, the tech, in order to get access to the remote machines. You can use their infrastructure in order to knit the machines together. But if that makes you feel uncomfortable, you can also use a self-hosted server, which you put somewhere, which allows these things to all connect to each other through NAT. So this all does NAT, NAT routing and rendezvous services. There's also an agent which can be used for spontaneous access to a remote system without installation. You would just if you immediately needed to get access to a remote system, you would just send this agent to that person who would run it on their machine, and then you would have access to it with the proper security. PC World, in their review of remote utilities, wrote, "For power users, there's plenty to like about remote utilities. Several connection modes are offered beyond the full remote desktop experience. There's also file transfer mode, remote device manager, a registry viewer, remote webcam access, and a terminal mode, which is an excellent way to perform simple command line tasks remotely. There's an MSI configurator to create custom host installers for unattended access, or to customize the remote agent module where you could put your own company logo and welcome text for attended support. It supports power control mode, allowing you to remotely restart a PC either in normal or safe mode, shut it down, lock it, put it to sleep. Active Directory support. You can fetch an Active Directory tree, add new domain controllers, and access Active Directory workstations and servers with one click. It's got two-factor authentication, time-based token for access to specific or every remote host. It just goes on and on. All the connections are TLS 1.2 that cannot be turned off. Encryption is always on. You can encrypt your address book in case the viewer's workstation was ever compromised to keep a bad guy from using that to get into the remote systems that you have access to. Host identity is certificate-based to ensure you are connecting to the same host that you intend to and not some sort of spoof. You can deploy it in a totally isolated environment over a LAN where you have direct connection or over the public internet, which is how, for example, Lori and I use it. Blank passwords are not allowed. There are no default passwords either. I mean, these guys clearly understand security. They did everything right. It's got built-in protection against brute force cracking. When an excessive number of incorrect password attempts is seen, the system automatically begins increasing the amount of time required, and will lock out an IP that is failing at multiple requests. And of course, there is no ability to brute force because most systems are behind NAT, so there's no open ports either. Anyway, it goes on and on. It's just called remote utilities. I am in love with it. I wanted to make sure our listeners knew about it. The other thing I wanted to put, make sure that I sort of reminded people of, I'm still in love with sync.com, but it's limited to synchronizing a single folder tree among one among two or more Windows devices. It's perfect for what it does. I'm using it. I'm loving it. For that, it's great. But in another aspect of what we needed for Lori's deployment, we wanted a little directory tree that's underneath each of these neurofeedback app that are out in each of these deployed laptops, and there's 20 of them out at the moment. We wanted a little snippet of a directory tree to get synchronized back to the Drobo that we have in our location. And sync thing, again, it's, I've mentioned it before. I want to just to remind people of it. I was asked by somebody in Twitter who had a couple of QNAP servers, how he and his buddy could synchronize them to back each other's stuff up. And I was reminded of sync thing, which just does that perfectly, that you can run sync thing on QNAP. I'm running it on my Drobos. It, you know, runs on Mac and Windows and Linux, FreeBSD, Solaris, and OpenBSD. It's open everything, protocol, open source, open committee. I mean, it's a great tool, and it supports a far more flexible, like you can get yourself lost. You can create something so complex. So I have all of the machines that are out there synchronizing a snippet of their directory structure back to a compound directory structure on the Drobo, which Lori is able to see. Some of the folders are one-way synchronizing. So that, for example, logs that are external synchronize back to us. Some of them are the other one way in the other direction, so that if Lori drops a media file that she wants to go out to everybody, she just drops it in the media folder on the Drobo, and the next time everybody connects, they get updated automatically. And then some things are bi-directional synchronized, so that the most current copy is synchronized. Anyway, syncthing.net is that, and there's an investment you need, because it's kind of funky the way it works. It took a while for me to – I was going, huh, for a while. But once you understand the way it works, there's just nothing it can't do in terms of like options and features and the complexity that you're able to maintain. And again, it's all NAT penetrating. You can open a port if you want. You can allow it to use UPnP if you want, or you can allow it to use external relay servers, and it'll do that as well.
As you can see, I've been a very happy user for the last 5 or 6 months.
I didn't know that.
Oh, I love Sync Thing, because you don't need a third-party cloud storage. Yep. If you have enough devices, sync them all. In fact, after you mentioned sync.com, I kind of was looking for other things. I tried other third-party stuff, and then I found Sync Thing. I said, oh, that's exactly what Steve needs. I've been meaning to, mention this to you for some time now. But it's really great. All my systems are on it, which is nice if you have multiple systems, because then you can keep stuff in sync. I just did a hands-on Macintosh piece on it this past Saturday, ironically. So I'm meaning to ask you, because I really like this idea that each device has its unique identifier, plus each folder has its unique identifier. And even though I just showed both of those, it's secure, because if you, you know, entered into your sync thing, I want to join Leo's W6MUCOA9UF folder, I'd still have to give you permission to do it. So it's
correct.
It's secure in that regard.
What happens is if somebody were to grab that and drop it into their sync thing and try to create a connection, you a request on your end would pop up saying, hey, somebody, right, you know, got your ID. Do you want to allow it?
Right.
But that's also the cool thing is that
you can share
you
with anybody.
Easily create a directory,
yes,
and share it with a friend.
Yep.
They use that, and then you link those two things together. It's just, I mean, they just nailed it.
It reminds me of our old friend BitTorrent Sync, except it's done right. It's really, I think it's just exactly. And it's open source, so we don't have to guess what the protocol
is. It's open source. Everything is certificate-based. Yeah. That's basically a large fingerprint of the certificate that uniquely identifies that machine. But and you're able to do things like, say, if a new subfolder appears, or if a machine I'm connected to creates a new folder, I want to automatically grab it and start syncing it, or I don't. And I mean, again, there's so many features that you can get yourself, you know, a little tangled up. But for a power user, they nailed it. And massively cross-platform. It runs on everything.
That's why I use it. It's on my Linux machines. It's a daemon that runs in the background on all of my machines, Linux, Mac, and Windows. I love the file versioning. You have lots of choices of file versioning. And I often will do it send only, so I don't have to worry about syncing deletions. If you send it, make a send only, then that's basically a backup. Anything you change here will be synchronized, but nobody else's changes will be synchronized. So, it does take a little time to kind of figure it all out, but I'm supremely impressed with it. I'm glad you agree.
I'm really glad.
I didn't mean to ask you about it. Yeah, good, 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 good. And it's free.
Okay. Yes, and free. Exactly.
It's free.
It's
like everything.
Thank you very much, world.
World. Yep.
So, over the weekend, using DigiCert's entirely automated self-service system, I rekeyed all of GRC's certificates ahead of the next Tuesday, September 1st deadline, after which certs can only have a 397-day life rather than twice that. And among those that I rekeyed was GRC's revoked.grc.com cert, which I mentioned last week had expired, so that it was being dishonored due to expiration rather than revocation. So that for those listeners who had been using the service, and I learned that there were 580 some a day are going to the revoked.grc.com page. That system is up and running again.
Wow.
So I bought myself an extra year before I need to do all of that again. But I also realized a benefit of having the expiration date of all of my certs now synchronized. If we're going to be needing to do this annually, as I will starting 2 years from now, because from now on, certificates are going to be expiring annually. Doing that certificate renewal work in a single batch will at least be much more convenient than being interrupted multiple times per year.
You have a new holiday on your calendar, cert renewal day, and you just do it every year. Yeah.
Now, of course, it is the case that it's only necessary because I'm using OV certs, you know, organization validation as a class above the DV certs, the domain validation, which can be, and I recognize this, fully automated. And a lot of people are just going to say, okay, Gibson, you know, I don't care. I'm just going to, you know, use the Acme protocol with Let's Encrypt and let my server keep itself updated. And I get it. Maybe someday that'll happen, but for now, DigiCert has made this so simple for me that it's something that I enjoy, and all my certs are now synchronized. And I just wanted to mention that revoked.grc.com is back up and running again. One last bit. I meant to mention last week, Leo, and I know you'll appreciate this, that as a result of all the benchmarking R&D we've done, we have learned a great deal about SSDs operating in the real world. Samsung, Kingston, OCZ, Vertex, Crucial, and others. And what has surprised us all is the non-uniformity that many of them show in their operation. It's not what anyone would expect from something with the seeming purity of solid-state memory. That their operation was kind of all over the map and varied widely at the five different points where we are benchmarking them. The thing I meant to note was that one single brand stood out from all others. Samsung was by far the most rock solid, and every one of those that we saw followed, and like there were many of them represented in the population that have been looked at so far. They all followed the governing specifications to the letter, which many did not, but also the performance was just solid.
Yeah, there's so, my favorite, the Evos.
Yes.
Really love those.
That I just wanted to say that I'm sure that the gang who were working with me in the spinrite.dev group all will see their future purchases biased, all other things being equal, toward Samsung, because we all were going, wow. Because, yeah. I mean, we're all sharing all of our results, and it's like, whoa, okay. And let's take our last break. I obviously need to have a sip of coffee. And then we're going to talk about a very cool high-tech hack on low-tech hardware.
Ooh, I don't know what that is, but it sounds good. Let me get our final sponsor queued up here, and we will give Steve a chance to hydrate while I tell you a little bit about something I call Extra Hop. Well, actually, they call it too. So it's nice. I mean, there's some synchronicity there. Extra Hop's an interesting company because they started by doing performance monitoring. They put Extra Hop sensors all over the network, everywhere out there, your network, clients' networks, the cloud networks, for performance monitoring. It turns out there's a real benefit to doing that. So not only do you see performance, but you also see threats and risks, the new IT reality. And it's funny that we should have been talking about this today, is remote access, right, on a massive scale, rapid cloud and multi-cloud adoption, a steady increase in Internet of Things devices, everything we talk about on this show, including a huge rise in cybercrime. More important than ever that organizations can see what's going on in their environment. And when I say in their environment, I mean everywhere, from your systems to the cloud, to the data center, to the customer. And in order to protect your business, in order to scale your business, you need unified visibility. You need the context for your detections. You need intelligent response workflows so your teams can collaborate easily and act fast. You need Extra Hop. This is the best way to gain insight into everything that's going on your network, from you to your customer and back. Extra Hop helps businesses stop breaches 70% faster. Let me explain. It's because Extra Hop eliminates blind spots and detects threats that other tools completely miss, that they can keep your business secure and available. It's a SaaS-based cloud-native network detection and response solution used by a lot of people. For instance, we talked to Wizards of the Coast's their chief architect and information security officer, Dan McDaniel. Wizards of the Coast, you know, they do the Magic, the Gathering, and all of that. They secure and support their cloud. They're on AWS using ExtraHop. Dan said there's no other company that aligns to supporting the DevOps model. That is the speed, the lack of friction, than ExtraHop. You've probably seen the name Ulta Beauty. There's one in our local mall over here. They use ExtraHop to secure their Google Cloud, as well as keeping their network and security teams closely aligned. You know, when you've got a lot of outlets, you've got e-commerce, your engineers have a lot to work on, but you want them to focus on innovation too. We talked to senior IT engineer John Kreese. He says, quote, before ExtraHop, we had limited visibility into what was going on in the cloud, but now we can quickly identify vulnerabilities and exploits and understand how our applications are performing in the cloud. You want to take control of your cloud security, and you want to do it with a tool that's been around, that's a proven track record that really, really works. That's ExtraHop. You want to know more about how ExtraHop stops breaches 70% faster? There's a free trial. You can try it yourself. ExtraHop.com. Yeah, you got it. /security now. ExtraHop. Think of a little bunny taking one extra hop. ExtraHop.com/security now. This is a solution that has evolved to really provide exactly what its customers need. Some of the biggest companies in the world use it, and you will want to too. ExtraHop.com/security now. Now, back to Steve.
So, we already know that smartphone cameras now have sufficient resolution.
Yes.
And our software has become sufficiently clever that a photo of a traditional house key at a distance can be used to reconstruct a working physical key.
Yes.
And we also know that the vibrations of objects in a distant room.
Right.
We've talked about balloons, a bag of potato chips, a light bulb, or even the leaves of a plant can be observed optically by laser or similar technology at a distance to reconstruct the acoustic waves those objects are being subjected to eavesdrop on conversations occurring in that room. And now, with the publication of some intriguing new research, another piece of our traditional perception and assumption of security has just fallen to the wayside. The research paper, which documents the detailed and painstaking work by three quite enterprising students in the Department of Computer Science at the National University of Singapore, bears the title, Listen to Your Key Towards Acoustic-Based Physical Key Inference.
Oh, no. 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 Oh, my God.
Yes.
Okay.
The abstract of the paper reads, physical locks are one of the most prevalent mechanisms for securing objects such as doors. While many of these locks are vulnerable to lockpicking, they are still widely used as lockpicking requires specific training with tailored instruments and easily raises suspicion. In this paper, we propose Spikey, a novel attack that significantly lowers the bar an attacker as opposed to the lock-picking attack by requiring only the use of a smartphone microphone to infer the shape of the victim's key, namely bitings or cut depths, which form the secret of a key. When a victim inserts his or her key into the lock, the emitted sound is captured by the attacker's microphone. Spikey leverages the time difference between audible clicks to ultimately infer the biting information, i.e., the shape of the physical key. As a proof of concept, we provide a simulation based on real-world recordings and demonstrate a significant reduction in search space from a pool of more than 330,000 keys to 3 candidate keys for the most frequent case. Okay. So in other words, yes, Leo, these researchers have shown that just capturing the sound of a traditional physical key being slid into its lock is all that's needed to recreate that key with a high level of confidence. A nearby smartphone or even the house's nearby smart doorbell microphone provides audio which is sufficiently accurate to provide the clues. We all know how a traditional physical lock and key work, right? Inside the lock are a series of 6 spring-loaded pins, which are each split at a different location along their length. When the proper key is inserted into the lock, the ridges on the key pushing against those internal springs positions each of the pins such that the splits in the pins line up with the edge of the lock's cylinder. Thus, no pin prevents the cylinder from then freely rotating in the lock. And I suppose, because I'm a bit odd, throughout my lifetime, I've often stopped to appreciate the sheer beauty of that simple invention. It requires no power. It is durable and largely weatherproof, except in the face of extreme freezing. And it's extremely reliable, so much so that its failure is vanishingly infrequent. And when it does eventually fail, typically after decades of reliable use and wear, it does so in a fail-soft fashion only after providing ample clues that its need for servicing is becoming acute, so such that jiggling the key in the lock is a long-standing meme. But mostly, it achieves all this in an example of a brilliant trade-off. We get all of that in return for accepting that it's not perfect protection. Is it cryptographically secure? Of course not. Can it be picked and defeated by anyone skilled in the art with a few simple lock-picking tools? Yep. Are there sufficient combinations that no one else's key will open it? No. A famous hack is just to try locks with keys they don't belong to. Sometimes you just get lucky, specifically because the universe of all possible combinations is comparatively small. But the likelihood of any random key working in any random lock is low enough that no one bothers to try. But it's exactly that comparatively small universe of possibilities that allows this research to succeed. Once the audio of a key insertion has been obtained, Spikey's inference software gets to work, filtering the signal to extract the comparatively strong metallic clicks as the key's ridges hit the lock's pins. The click occurs when one of the spring-loaded pins crosses over the top of any of the key's ridges. I have a picture, a photo, a diagram from their PDF, which shows that in the instance of the click occurring on the six pins. They explain, as I just did, how the lock works mechanically, and then the event of the click. And they have a photogram of the audio, at which plays from Google, which you can hear. And Leah, you should probably put this into the podcast. It's GRC's shortcut of the week. So it's grc.sc/781. And there it is.
And of course, we've all heard this, but you don't pay any attention to it, right?
Exactly.
And it doesn't sound this clear, but I guess modern phone microphones are good enough. They could pick it up.
Yes. So basically, they say, well, so
the grooves on clicks, the side don't do diddly. It's just
correct.
It's just the teeth.
The
bittings.
Well, now, okay, so the grooves in the side do create classes of keys which will work in the lock.
Ah, right.
And those do differ from, you know, among brands and within brands. So that does create subsets.
Right. But you can easily, there probably aren't that many sets, I would guess.
Exactly. There are not.
Yeah.
And so for example, many times your key won't even go in.
Yeah, yeah.
And then if it does, then it will go in, but it won't turn.
Right.
So anyway, the clicks drive the inference analysis. It's the time between the clicks, which allows the spiky software, which they've developed, to compute the key's inter-ridge distances and what locksmiths refer to as the biting depth of those ridges, which is how deeply they cut down into the key shaft and where they plateau out. If a key were to be inserted at a non-constant speed, the analysis would be defeated, though the software can compensate for small insertion speed variations. So, but if you were like, if this freaked you out and you were at high risk, you felt, then you could simply start inserting your key at a non-constant pace and you would defeat this. But given all the available acoustic information, complete disambiguity cannot be obtained. So they end up with multiple possible keyings in the best case. And this is why the paper's abstract noted that the spiky software will output the three most likely key designs to fit the lock that was used in the audio provided by that file, which does reduce the potential search space, as they said, from 330,000, which is the universe of possible combinations, down to just three. They said, when a victim inserts a key into the door lock, an attacker walking by records the sound with a smartphone microphone. Spiky detects the timing of these clicks from the sound. We then utilize the click timestamps to compute the adjacent inter-ridge distances given a constant insertion speed. We use the computed distances to infer the relative differences of adjacent biting depths, which Spiky exploits to ultimately obtain a small subset of candidate keys that includes the victim's key code. They said, we detect all click events from the audio recording. They do subject it to a high-pass filter to reduce the impact of low-frequency ambient noise, retaining only frequencies above 15 kilohertz that contains the information, the acoustic information about the clicks. And they said, subsequently, we identified the starting point of each click or its onset in the pre-processed signal by applying change point detection algorithm on short time windows around the computed peaks to account for their millisecond granularity. They said it finds the least sum of standard deviations across two regions that transition from low to high amplitude. That is, in terms of the amplitude of the click sound. So they got they did some serious acoustic processing to absolutely nail down the time event of the click. For anyone who's interested, I've got the PDF link to their research in the paper. It goes on to explain exactly how they convert the click onset timings into a few possible candidate keyings. So anyway, I just thought, you know, one more long-standing, time-honored piece of real-world technology has just fallen. Hysterical. We can no longer insert our key into a lock without the possibility of somebody simply eavesdropping. And you can imagine, Leo, if you had a telephoto microphone at a distance, you know, aimed at that lock, and, you know, if somebody were to insert the key, it would be able to pick it up at a distance with a big parabolic mic and capture the sound. And wow, that would be enough.
Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that cool?
Just amazing. How doable do you think that is? I mean, I know it's theoretically, of course, but
I mean, they did it. They recorded it.
They were able to make the key.
They wrote the software. It designed three keys, and one of those three opened the lock.
Wow. Isn't that great? I think you got to admire the ingenuity and the cleverness involved. Whether this is I could see a big three-letter agency using this. We should write this into the next Jason Bourne script or something. I think that'd be
useful. So it would be useful in a situation where you would be observed picking the lock. Certainly a three-letter agency would have people who can, you know, pick a lock.
Get it right
in. You know,
yeah.
I can pick a lock. You can pick a lock. Yeah. You know, techies know how to do that. It's just, you know, it's not that difficult. But during the process, you're observable. So if you had a scenario where someone posing as a, you know, a cable TV serviceman or maybe the house cleaner, you know, needed to just be able to walk up, quickly insert the key and enter, you'd want to be prepped ahead of time. And so this would allow you to produce one of three keys where they could look like they were fumbling for the right key among their key ring. But in fact, they were trying, you know, the subset of possibilities. And then it's like, oh, yeah, there it is. And then they, you know, waltz right in with everybody else standing around watching them.
Wow, that's wild. Steve, you've done it again. I always do. It's fascinating stuff. And that's why we listen each and every Tuesday to Security Now. You can get Steve's famous SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility, at his website, grc.com. Version 6 is out. 6.1 is on its way. By 6 today, you'll get 6.1 for free, and you could participate in the building of 6.1, which is moving apace. That's all at grc.com. You'll also find the show there. He's got 16 kilobit and 64 kilobit versions of the show, the audio. And he's got transcriptions, which are very handy if you like to read along while you listen. He also has lots of other free stuff there, so check it out, grc.com. You can leave feedback there, grc.com/feedback, or leave it for him on Twitter. Steve is a Twitter user, and his Twitter handle is at SGGRC. Do you respond to people, though, as much as just if people leave you a message, you get it?
I do when I can, but frankly, there's overwhelming.
It is.
I figure people would rather I got SpinRite 6.1 done than spend a day responding to private tweets. So
I try to read them. I get a lot of email every day. And it breaks my heart because it's almost, for me, it's people who listen to the tech guy and who have fairly basic questions and they're suffering and they can't find help. But if I answered that email, I wouldn't be able to do anything else. So that's all we can do. We do what we do as best we can. Of course, what you should do is you just come back here every Tuesday around about 1:30 Pacific. That's 4:30 Eastern. That's 20:30 UTC. That's when we record the show. You can watch us do it live at twit.tv/live. There's audio and video there. If you're doing that, chat with us. The chat room is irc.twit.tv. You can also get on-demand versions of the show, not just at Steve's site, but at our site, in this case, twit.tv/SN. Of course, it's on YouTube, and you can always subscribe. Get your favorite podcast app and subscribe to Security Now, because you don't want to miss an episode. You want the complete set. Collect all 999. Eventually, that's the number. This is episode 781. And I thank you, Steve. Have a great week, and we'll see you next
week. Thank you, my friend. Righto. Bye.
Want more TWIT? Well, check out Smart Tech Today. It's at twit.tv/STT. It's the show where Matthew Casinelli and I cover everything there is to know about smart tech. It's automation. It's connected devices. It's smart home. It's all those goodies and so much more. We get the news. We get the latest devices. We do reviews. Everything. You got to check it out. twit.tv/STT for Smart Tech Today.
Security Now.